Welcome everybody to this first of our Cold War Studies Center public lectures for this term. If everybody could turn off their telephones, thank you very much. We have an interesting and I think vital program for this, and I'm delighted to welcome you here this evening for this first lecture. When the Cold War Studies Center was created a couple of years ago, I think we set out with two fundamental issues in mind. One, more generally, was the theme of history as critical to an understanding of the present. And secondly, and connected, that the present and the world crisis which we face is a product of many factors and forces, but most critically, the Cold War and the way the Cold War ended. The Cold War may be over, but to use a phrase, its fingerprints are all over the world today. And nowhere is this more evident than in the Middle East, where the end of the Cold War has left an indelible legacy, both, I suppose, particularly in terms of American preponderance, and secondly, in terms of the ideological forces which are at play there. So I'm delighted this evening to invite along, I think, two of the people who would be regarded as two of the greatest experts, at least in this country and globally, on the region in general and Iraq in particular. To my left, Dr. Toby Dodge from the Queen Mary University of London. Toby, as you know, is the new kid on the block who's written with great wisdom, with great incision, and with great sagacity on the question of Iraq. Toby is now well known as the man who gave advice to the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister didn't listen. If you saw that particular program. So Toby, your advice will be listened to this evening. And welcome, Toby, of course, from the Queen Mary University, London. Professor Fred Halliday, as they say, is a national treasure. Certainly a treasure at the London... well, Fred, Fred is playing his Irish card this evening. So I say he's both an Irish and a British national treasure, and indeed a world treasure. Okay, Fred, I'm talking at the moment. You can get on with it later on. It's actually difficult to say what Fred has written about, because he's written about everything. The question is what Fred has not written about, but he's written about Iran, the United States, world politics. Fred is the true public intellectual. He's been a fantastic person within this university and in this town, with many, many things to say, and he's going to say them this evening, I hope, with Fred's typical panache. However, with no further ado, I want to welcome Toby from the University of London, from Queen Mary, to start the discussion on still the arc of crisis, the Middle East from the Cold War to Iraq. Toby, it's over to you. Thanks very much, Toby.
Well, thank you, Mick, for the invitation, and thank you all for turning up in such large numbers on a cold winter's night so early in the new year. It's certainly an honour to be in the hallowed halls of the London School of Economics. Always a pleasure to come back. And more importantly, I think, sandwiched between the august company of two senior professors, who I hope you'll see in a while, whose work has influenced me greatly. Now, I think Mick, by calling me the new kid on the block, I didn't feel that new when I woke up this morning, but that's probably my problem, alluded to the fact that of what I've been doing over the last few years, and it's been a really strange sensation. Having worked on Iraq for the last decade. So when I first started, it was a country locked away under sanctions, of little import to academics and not much import to policymakers, who were embarrassed about the ongoing sanctions, the survival of the regime. Now, from 2002, life got very much more interesting, and I now study a country that has been thrust to the center of British and American domestic policy, as well as at the cutting edge of international relations. I now study a state the collapse of which has become crucial to the legacies of the current Prime Minister and the US President. It will now play a crucial role in the stability of the wider Middle East, but sadly, in a way, not the role that George Bush and Tony Blair had planned for it when they launched the invasion in March 2003. So let me focus on four main issues during my talk tonight to explain this sudden leap to prominence of Iraq and its ramifications for the evolution of post-Cold War international relations. I think the first thing I want to do is doff my cap to the center and to the topic of the talk series. And I want to briefly touch upon the legacies that the end of the Cold War left for the Middle East. I then want to move on to why these legacies led to the, directly to the decision of the current US government to invade Iraq in 2003. And I think thirdly, I want to look at the way the invasion has gone so cataclysmically wrong. I think there's very little doubt, certainly in Iraq, in London, in Whitehall, and indeed slowly but surely in the Beltway in Washington, that that invasion has been a cataclysmic mistake. And finally, what I want to do is conclude and lead on to the discussions by suggesting the serious problems for Iraq, the region, and specifically the United States that the failure in Iraq will slowly give rise to. So first, let's look at the legacies of the Cold War. The end of the Cold War, the victory of the US and Western Europe, led firstly to the triumphant celebration of neoliberal views of globalization. The end of history was proclaimed, and the doctrine of TINA, there is no alternative, was promoted, at least in the pages of The Economist, that you had to throw open the doors of your nation's economy and society to the transformative effects of foreign direct investment. And finally, the dominance of a supposedly cosmopolitan international culture based on a universalizing mantra of liberal individualism was at large in the world and working its wonder. But beyond that triumphalism and I suppose idealistic universalism, how did the end of the Cold War in 1989 leave the Middle East? I think crucially and economically, the supposed benefits of globalization bypassed the Middle East. Although the last 20 years has seen the developing world's share of foreign direct investment rise sharply, the Middle East and North Africa's share of this has been very small. In 1994 to 1996, for example, the Middle East was the recipient of only 1% of all global foreign direct investment. Now, clearly, to a certain extent, this can be linked to the region's dependence upon oil for its foreign currency. This has led states, firstly, to neglect other regions of their economy, depending from between a 90 to 100% on export earnings, but also it has given states both economic and political autonomy from the globalizing world, from the strictures of neoliberalism. The imposition of neoliberal policy prescriptions through the rise of the Washington Consensus in the 1980s and the development of good governance in the 1990s has had a minimal effect on the region. Tunisia signed its first deal with the World Bank in 1986, certainly, and it was followed by Egypt in 1987 and Jordan in 1990. However, the effects of these agreements on how those governments conducted their business, on how states interacted with their societies and economies, was extremely limited. In the post-Cold War euphoria of the early 1990s, both scholars, intellectuals, and pundits argued that the economic and especially the political transformation of globalization was imminent in the Middle East. This sense of democratic possibility was enhanced, momentarily at least, by the claim that the first Gulf War in 1990 was being fought in the name of democracy, human rights, and a new world order. The rhetoric of Arab nationalism at this point in the mid-90s, of state-delivered economic growth, and even dare we say socialism, was looking a little jaded as the lack of economic development in the more populous Arab countries of the region became apparent. However, let's now turn to 2003, the spring of 2003. On the eve of the invasion of Iraq, I think it would be easy to argue and defend the case that the scale of promised transformation that globalization seemed to hold was in the Middle East extremely modest, to say the least. The average time in tenure of rulership for leaders in the region was 20 years. Remarkable when compared to a decade in Africa and on average 3 years in Europe. The much heralded democratic transformation had yet to arrive, and the states of the Middle East had used oil, or the ruling elites of the Middle East had used oil or inter-regional rents to, if anything, exacerbate their autonomy from society and fend off the demands of globalization and US-promoted neoliberalism. It is this lack of economic liberalization and political democratization that drove George Bush to invade Iraq in 2003. For the US administration, 9/11 ended what they had termed the decade of complacency. The aftermath of 9/11 was clearly seen by the neoconservatives as an opportunity to rework the envelope within which American foreign policy had up to that moment been conducted. The right to sovereignty was now to be balanced with the responsibilities imposed by the United States. No weapons of mass destruction, no sponsoring of asymmetrical warfare or terrorism, and transparent banking so Al-Qaeda couldn't move money through your economy. For the Bush administration, as it set about applying its new doctrine in the aftermath of 9/11, the Ba'athist regime in Baghdad was a glaring example of the previous limits of US hegemony. Firstly, it was a defiant third world state. Over the 1990s, despite invasion, continuous bombing, and over a decade of the harshest sanctions ever imposed, it continued to reject the demands of the US and the international community. Secondly, the stalemate in Iraq personified the problems writ large faced by the US hegemony in the Middle East. The autonomy built up by the Ba'athist regime over 35 years of rule allowed it to defy the institutions of the international community and resist the application of 13 years of post-war coercive diplomacy. Conversely, for Bush and his team, if it could be removed, if the full force of the US military might could be displayed in one of the most important states in the region, then the rest of the Arab regimes could be made to submit to US policy demands, neoliberal globalization, and ultimately democratization. It is indicative of the importance of the US and the problems of Iraq that posed to the... it is indicative of the importance that the Middle East and Iraq posed to US hegemony that both dominated the first meeting of George W. Bush's National Security Council, a mere 10 days after his inauguration. Condoleezza Rice, in the chair, explained, quote, how Iraq is destabilizing the region, end of quote, and how it might be the key to reshaping the Middle East. To quote Rumsfeld during the second NSC meeting of the new administration, quote, imagine what the region would look like without Saddam and with a regime that's aligned to US interests. It would change everything in the region and beyond it. It would demonstrate what US foreign policy was all about. In the aftermath of 9/11 and what was seen at the time to have been a successful war in Afghanistan, Iraq was invaded to remove a decade-long obstacle to US power in the Middle East, but also as a direct result of the limits of hegemony, the limits that hegemony had faced in the wider region. Now let me move on to discuss the reasons for the failure of that of the aftermath of that invasion. Now, I would think, and we'll obviously revisit this if you disagree in questions, that there is little doubt that the post-war occupation of Iraq has been a cataclysmic failure. As of the 10th of January this year, a total of 2,210 American service personnel were killed there. Iraq body count conservatively estimates that anything between 28 and 31,000 innocent Iraqi civilians have lost their lives since March 2003. After the failure to find weapons of mass destruction, the Abu Ghraib torture scandal, the lofty rhetoric of Iraq being a democratic beacon, showing the way for the transformation of the Middle East, has been quietly dropped in favor of a much more limited justification, stressing the global war against terrorism. As Rumsfeld has recently repeated, it's better to fight terrorists on the streets of Baghdad than in downtown Manhattan or Houston. Yet still the violence continues, with a largely indigenous insurgency estimated around 20,000 strong, managing to continually hit the US with a large amount of vigor and violence. For example, US forces were attacked 100 times a day in October 2005, 90 times in November, and down to the three-yearly average of 75 times a day in December. Now, with the publication of a series of books of people who worked for the Coalition Provisional Authority, academics like Larry Diamond and Noah Feldman, I don't know, state change technocrats like Mark Etherington, there now appears to be growing a conventional wisdom about why things went so badly wrong. This would firstly stress the huge shortfall in troop numbers. Now, quite famously, in a Senate hearing in February 2003, in the run-up to the war, the then U.S. Army Chief of Staff, Eric Shinseki, who was sacked for his troubles, stated that something in the order of several hundred thousand troops would be needed to stabilize Iraq. A widely cited study on state building published by Rand just after the invasion concluded that occupying forces would need 20 security personnel, police and troops per thousand people to stabilize the country. This compares to 43 per thousand that Saddam Hussein had in power. This means that coalition forces to be successful in the aftermath of regime change would have needed 400 to 500,000 troops in order to impose order. Instead, Donald Rumsfeld's obsession with the supposed benefits of the revolution in military affairs meant that the US had a mere 116,000 soldiers on the ground in Iraq in the midst of the invasion. Now, the second accepted reason, which I also agree with, for the failure is the ideological driven nature of the civilian planning for the aftermath of the war. Best case scenarios, wishful thinking, and an almost complete lack of knowledge about the country that they were invading was combined with blithe assertions and dogma to undermine any substantial planning or risk analysis. Now, these two, I think, are accepted, and they're shaping the debate on the failure in Iraq. However, I think there are four more persuasive ideas that are at the moment largely unexplored, but need to be put on the table to explain the failure in Iraq, but also if state building, if regime change is to become a tool of a liberal international agenda to work out how things could be done better. I think the first, and Mick has already alluded to where I might have got this from. The first is that the expectations of both senior British and American politicians about how the war was to be fought. Based on Pentagon briefings, senior civilians at the height of power in both London and Washington were convinced there would be a coup as soon as the war started. That either as the air war started or as the first foreign boots hit Iraqi soil, the Iraqi army would do the work of the coalition, move in, remove Saddam Hussein, and then turn around and negotiate with the incoming troops. At worst, if this didn't work, then the decapitation thesis promoted by Ahmad Shalabi would operate. Saddam Hussein's loyal lieutenants, the pack of cards, would be swiftly removed as in a short race of the US military to Baghdad. The state would then hold and provide order while its institutions were reformed and the pro-American, formerly Washington-based exiles were installed. Now, this, I think, is closely linked to the neoliberal ideology of those who were seeking regime change. And this is the second idea that I think we should think about. US intervention in Iraq was never perceived within the rubric of state building and was certainly never sold to the US population as an extended occupation. It was seen at best as a limited exercise in regime change and then state reform. The agenda of state reform, shaping the plans for post-war Iraq, had a heritage in over 20 years of World Bank and IMF structural adjustment. The idea that basically this would be the Washington consensus with guns, that the state would be seized and then shrunk while the reliance on the wisdom of the market would structure state-society relations. State collapse was never planned for, and indeed neoliberals may have a great philosophy about shrinking states and empowering the market, but they have very few tools to understand building anything more than a night watchman state and imposing order on a country. Which brings us to the third linked theme, that of state collapse. As we know, state collapse was the US Marines' arrival in Baghdad in April was greeted by the almost complete collapse of the state. Now, this should have been no surprise. For 13 years, Washington and London had been backing and demanding the imposition of draconian sanctions on Iraq that were designed to do exactly that, break the state, break the state's capacity. The only surprise should have been that the moment of this state collapse, long predicted, was actually in April as the Marines pulled down the statue of Saddam Hussein. Faced with widespread lawlessness that is common after a violent regime change, the US did not have the troops on the ground, nor the commitment, nor the expertise to control the situation and rebuild the state. After the state had been collapsed, after Ghana had been removed and replaced by Paul Bremer, US policy became reactive, stumbling from one failed decision to another, always missing whatever potential windows for opportunity there may have been to save the situation. The final argument, I think, for the failure of regime change is primordialism. This, I think, is the final and most destructive mistake made by US administrators on the ground. Convinced by those in the Iraqi National Congress, long exiled from Iraq, by those of the Kurdish Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, US policymakers worked on the idea that Iraqi society was undeniably divided by three homogeneous, mutually excluding and sectarian communities that had been kept apart, kept from each other's throats by a Leviathan-like state and would fall upon each other unless power was divided between them. By using this understanding to create the interim Iraqi governing council, by deploying a very rough and ready consociationalism, the coalition provisional authority has encouraged a sectarian dynamic that may yet come to dominate Iraqi politics and end up in widespread sectarianly driven violence. This certainly had the advantage of allowing its formerly exiled allies to pose as the representatives of Iraqi communalism, but its long-term ramifications may well be to leave a series of unrepresentative politicians at the head of a new state increasingly reliant on sectarian ideology to justify their unpopular rule while they asset strip what's left of Iraqi resources. So what we have is the collapse of a state, the now infamous disbanding of the army, de-Ba'athification, and also the legacy of Saddam Hussein, the legacy of intense violence and vast amounts of oil wealth that combed through Iraqi society, breaking any social organization that had the capacity to organize against the state. What we have now is anarchy, is a war of all against all. The insurgency portrayed in the British media as some kind of Sunni plot to reestablish itself is actually made up of 74 separate indigenous groups fighting on a basis of locality, intense geography, family, and kinship ties in their own regions with a violent and external Zakawi-driven terrorist move on top. So where does this failure to pacify Iraq, where does this failure to rebuild the Iraqi state, where does the death of 2,200 US servicemen and the increasing unpopularity of the occupation leave American policy in the Middle East? Well, studies of military intervention divide them broadly into three phases. The first phase is the initial decision to intervene, driven by two common misperceptions. Firstly, that intervention will be relatively short in duration, and secondly, the belief that military force will enable the intervening power to achieve the durable political objectives that they intervened for. The second phase is the middle game, the staying in phase, a denial of failure, a refusal to admit the facts on the ground, a hope that if you keep pursuing the same policy, still bet on black, as it were, things will come all right in the end. Now, the final stage ends the middle stage, and that's the decision to disengage, to cut losses, and to pull out. I think for this current case study, for the case study of US intervention in Iraq, it's very interesting that the final stage, the disengagement stage, in almost every case study looked at, needs a change of administration at home, a change of government in the intervening state. So after failing to stabilize Iraq, the current US government has come face to face with the high costs of its new forward-leaning Bush doctrine. But in spite of rising costs, increasing unpopularity at home. I think the Bush administration will continue through until 2008 to gamble on resurrection, keep looking for the light at the end of the tunnel, claim that it will keep drawing down troops, but basically continue the occupation. Now, if I'm right, that means that the US presidential elections in 2008 will be dominated by one who is to blame for this costly debacle, but more interesting, two, who is best qualified to extricate America from this mess. Now, what are the ramifications for pulling America out of Iraq? I think there are three. One is domestic Iraqi, and probably that's the greatest. Two is regional, and three is America itself. Success in Iraq was placed at the center of an ambitious plan to transform the political and economic trajectory of the region as a whole. A democratic and prosperously free market Iraq would, it was argued, act as a beacon of light, leading the rest of societies and states behind them to democratic transformation. However, once the post-Saddam electoral process finally got underway, instead of producing Jeffersonian Democrats, the polls last time, and I suspect this time when the results are declared, have been dominated by the United Iraqi Alliance, an electoral grouping specifically created firstly to ensure the triumph of political parties formed around the promotion of Islam at the heart of the state. Secondly, and I think more ironically and more worryingly, the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, those that are dominating the government in Baghdad at the moment, were formed in Tehran at the height of the Iranian Revolution in 1982. And they were formed explicitly as a vehicle for Iranian foreign policy in Iraq. In effect, because they are one of the most organized political forces on the ground, because they benefit from American backing, but also from large-scale Iranian financing, the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, a vehicle created to further Iranian policy, is dominating the government in Baghdad and may well provide the next prime minister. Another unintended consequence of the invasion in the aftermath is how the exiles that played such a central role in its cheerleading have fared. Ahmed Chalabi, a politician of mercurial skill and certainly unbounded flexibility, took the temperature of Iraqi politics after being flown back to the country on a US Air Force plane and then radically transformed his previous commitment to neoconservatism. Firstly, in an unsuccessful attempt to gain some degree of popularity and shake off his reputation as an American stooge, he aligned himself with the promotion of Shia Islam and tried to cuddle up to Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. When that failed, ironically, he repackaged himself as a militant Iraqi nationalist. This, his relationship with the US, reached a nadir when American troops raided his palatial Baghdad residence looking for evidence of his alleged intelligence links with Iran. So I think, at best, Iran, if it does stabilize, and I have no reason to think it will be an Iraq, if it does stabilize, will be an Iranian client state to some degree, with the dominant party running large swathes of the government being the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and the most powerful security organization, the Badr Brigade, being a trained and staffed Iranian militia until it went back to Iraq. I'm not sure if the Revolutionary Guard still provide the officer corps for the Badr Brigade, but they certainly did up until 2003 when it entered the country. Now, regionally, the ramifications either of an Iran-dominated state or, much likely, a clapped state, what we have today, are particularly worrying. The hotel bombings in Amman, in Jordan, against the five-star Western hotels are clearly an example of Iraqi contagion, of the spread of the Zarqawi network back into Jordan, where Zarqawi was born. But in Saudi Arabia, Alfi, the 33-year-old who proclaimed himself head of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in July 2004, gained his military experience fighting US forces in Iraq in 2003 and 2004. Othman Amri, the 19th man on the Saudis' most wanted list, surrendered to the authorities in June 2004 during an amnesty, having spent the previous 12 months fighting Iraq. Now, I suspect Fred will touch on Iran, but clearly the great irony of the situation, the EU3 and the US attempts to disarm Iran, or at least to stop Iran's nuclear program, is that Iran has its hands under Iraq. That the sudden upsurge in the death of UK personnel in and around Basra has been explicitly linked by the British Foreign Office to Iranian involvement in Iraq, and was timed, to my eyes at least, to coincide with the rising pressure on Tehran. The US no longer talks about military options in Iran, realizes that its army is tied down in Iraq, but the UK had the wit to realize that the British position in the south is more and more dependent on Iranian quiescence. That leads us to the final point, the more general point about US power projection after the failure in Iraq. So beyond the ideological shortcomings of the US administration's vision for post-war Iraq, it is the US military's inability to control the country that continues to cause the greatest damage to the potential for American hegemony in the region. The Bush administration convinced its electorate that the invasion would curtail the threat of asymmetrical warfare personified by 9/11. With this in mind, it is tragically ironic that over 2,000 American soldiers to date have been killed by just that. Asymmetrical warfare pursued by a disparate bunch of Iraqi insurgents combining radical nationalism of ex-Baathists and Islamic radicalism of both the indigenous Iraqis and the Zaqawi network. I'll leave you with this one thought. The insurgency's ability to innovate technologically and deploy increasing levels of violence has humbled the military capacity of the world's sole remaining superpower. To put it in crude terms, Islamic radicals with RPGs have brought the US military to its knees. What will this mean for threats of US coercive action? What will this mean for US power projection out of area, let alone into the Middle East, where the open sore of Iraq will continue to hurt the United States until they decide to swallow the bitterest pill and pull out? Thank you very much.
Okay, now over to Fred. Fred?
Well, thanks very much, and thanks to the Cold War Center for this. Mention is made in the publicity for this meeting of the phrase arc of crisis, and I thought I might mention briefly a bit of archaeology, as they say, of where this phrase comes from. The term was coined in the late 1970s by the American strategist and presidential advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, and was meant to refer to a range of countries in the Middle East and its environs where there had been serious political upheaval, revolution at that time, and also, in the eyes of Washington at least, a considerable Soviet advance. And there were four countries in particular which were linked at that time in this arc of crisis. There was, first of all, Ethiopia, which had been an American ally for a long time, which was the site in 1974 and in subsequent years of a major social and political upheaval, which overthrew the monarchy, carried out land reform, led to war with Somalia, and produced a dictatorial military regime which lasted till 1991. Secondly, there was a country where I choose to do my PhD and where I was living at this time, not the most memorable chapter in the Cold War, but one close to my heart, the Socialist Revolution in the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. I finally published my thesis, which is a fine book, in March 1990, and 2 months later, lo and behold, the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen disappeared in a merger with North Yemen. And I think the book has sold 327 copies, but fine copies they are. And and I did find somebody citing it the other day. Long forgotten as the Yemeni revolution is, even by the people of Yemen, where I was visiting last year, it retains a place in my heart, not least for one of the revolutionary songs, which I still have a disc of, calling for the arming of the women. We must, Tasli al-Marawajib is the song, we must arm the women. I don't think any other revolution in the world has yet got that far, and more's the pity. The third country was Iran, the Iranian Revolution of 1978-79, which overthrew another monarchy allied to the United States and produced the advent of the Islamic Republic. I'd been in Iran in the 60s, I'd been banned thereafter, but I went back in the summer of 79 and maintained an interest there. And the fourth country was Afghanistan, where in April 1978, in the last attempted socialist revolution of the 20th century, the Communist Party, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, took power in a military coup. I think the only pure military coup in which communists ever actually took power, although 1917 had the odd shade of being a military coup. And this seizure of power in Afghanistan precipitated a civil war, aided by the Pakistanis, the Saudis, and the Americans on one side and the Soviets on the other, and led in December 1979 to the intervention of the Soviet troops, who stayed there for 10 years. So from the point of view of Washington in the late 70s, here was Ethiopia, South Yemen, Iran and Afghanistan, all in upheaval, all the Soviets taking advantage of it, and hence the phrase arc of crisis. Even at that time, there were skeptics. I remember somebody wrote an article about the different sort of geometrical models which are used to describe these things. There was the rhomboid of rhetoric, and there was the pretzel of provocation. I remember someone else came up with it. Recently from now, someone's just produced a book, Israeli authors produced a book on the Triangle of Terror, Yemen, Sudan, and Somalia. But there was an element of truth in this. I had occasion to visit each of those countries and write a bit about them. And two or three very quick observations, because they're relevant to today's discussion. The first was, when you went there, and this was true at the time, and even more so given the archives and memoirs which you now have, which the Cold War Center is valiantly collecting and documenting, it was obvious that while there may have been some advantage to the Soviet Union in these countries, the Soviet Union had very little to do with the outbreak of these events or with the course that they took. And indeed, the Soviets were almost as bewildered as everybody else, including in Afghanistan, by what actually happened. The Russians certainly did not support in any active way the coup of 1978, and they were very reluctant to send troops to Afghanistan until the situation got very out of control at the end of 1979. As for the Iranian Revolution, it owed nothing to the Soviet Union, and indeed the Russians were extremely annoyed at the anti-communist as well as anti-Western slogans which the Iranian Revolution expressed, because the Iranian Revolution then and now expressed the nationalism of the Iranian people, which, unlike most nationalisms, are not just directed against the West, or, as in the case of Eastern Europe, against the Soviet Union, was directed against both. Hence the slogan, Na Gharb Na Sharq, neither West nor East, which Imam Khomeini proclaimed. And of course, in this, Iran bears much similarity with one other great ancient Asian state, which was also faced with Western and Russian pressure, which was China, where again nationalism takes this form. So here we were confronted with what I would call the autonomy of local forces. And indeed, my main academic theme or beef, and I apologize to the students of mine who are in the room who've heard this already enough at 9 o'clock on a Wednesday morning these past term and a half, is that if we look back even on the Cold War and the colonial period, let alone now, local states and local actors had much more autonomy of the great powers than appeared at the time or than rhetoric would have us believe. And that goes to the Arab-Israeli dispute as well. The Russians didn't control the PLO. In fact, nobody controlled the PLO once they got up and running. Nor, in any real sense, did the West ever control first the Zionist movement up to 48 and the State of Israel thereafter. And both the Israelis and the Palestinians knew how and know how to play their autonomy vis-a-vis the great powers. And I think that's an important lesson when we hear about state-sponsored terrorism today and everything being ascribed to Iran or Iraq, and forget this very important feature of autonomy. And even if groups were originally set up by states, they learned pretty quickly to slip the leash. This was true of the PLO, which was set up by the Arabs in 64, but slipped the leash after 1967. And it's true of bin Laden. Bin Laden was put in business by the Americans, the Saudis, and the Pakistanis in the 80s. I've said on other occasions, he's the illegitimate child of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. And he was not against receiving economic support from the West, then from Sudan and the Taliban, but he is, and his movement is, an autonomous force. The second point to make very quickly is that the crises of that time, and that would also include the spate of third world revolutions, which I once counted them. This is my one contribution to quantification in IR, as I counted the third world revolutions of the 1970s, and the total is 14, Vietnam, Grenada, Angola. So that's the limit of my quantification. But no one else did it. I did it. They played an important role, along with the shifting nuclear balance of the time, in the onset of what came to be called the Second Cold War, the period of Soviet-American confrontation of the 80s, the rise of Ronald Reagan, and all that went with it. So if we talk about the Cold War, let us talk about the nuclear arms race. Let us talk about the ideological confrontation. Let us talk about the division of Europe, which was, in many ways, the historic front line. But let us remember the Third World as well, and let us remember that while in Europe, apart from the Greek Civil War, very few people lost their lives in those 40 years, in the Third World, over 20 million people did, including in some of the countries which I've mentioned. But what is also striking is how the shadow of that arc of crisis period hangs over the present, and how looking back on it, and this is more clear to me now, these months than ever before, how the world that we now have was formed to a considerable degree in that period. And let me mention four trends of a general kind. First of all, if we talk about the Cold War in the Middle East and the sense of the Cold War in the Arab world, including the Arab-Israeli context, it lasted for a very short time. It lasted about 20 years. From the middle 1950s, and we will celebrate the anniversary of the Suez Crisis, 50th anniversary, later this year, from the mid-1950s to the mid-1970s, when the Egyptians chucked the Russians out of Egypt. Before that, the Arab world was not really affected by the Cold War. Don't let's forget, Stalin supported the Zionist movement, the Israeli independence movement in the war of 1948-49. And from 1975, the Soviet Union had virtually no serious influence in the Arab world at all. Moreover, the events of the arc of crisis, in large measure, and with the single exception of Afghanistan, marked the end of the Cold War in the rest of the Middle East as well. Because with the Iranian Revolution, you had, for the first time, a major radical movement that was both anti-Western and anti-Soviet, and remains so. The Russians, and I remember going to the Oriental Institute in Moscow and talking to experts this time, believe that in the end, as they used to put it, the mullahs will come to their senses. Well, the mullahs did not come to their senses in any realistic way. And the mullahs, indeed, apart from calling for revolution in Kashmir, Eritrea, Palestine, the Moro Islands, and so forth, were also calling for revolution in Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, which actually didn't have much effect, but nobody knew that at the time. Secondly, if by Cold War we mean the domination of a region by the East-West conflict, this ceased to be the case in September 1980 with the Iraqi invasion of Iran. Because from that moment on, this was the dominant conflict in the region, whose casualties dwarf by a scale of at least 10 all the casualties in all the Arab-Israeli conflicts there have been since 1948. And the West and the Soviet Union were on the same side, supporting Saddam against the mullahs. So we can say that for Iran and for the Arab world, and also for Turkey, which by then was on very good relations with Russia, not least because the Russians supported them over Cyprus, the Cold War ended in 1980, with the single exception, of course, of Afghanistan. On a footnote on which we can debate long and hard, what role did the war in Afghanistan play in the collapse of Soviet communism? I would say it played some role, not so much in the economic costs or in the 15,000 casualties, but in the ideological costs, the realization that communism could not be spread inexorably across the world, and the defeat of the invincibility of the Red Army. And of course, here the analogies with Iraq are very striking, because we remember what was the official title of the Soviet forces in Afghanistan. It was the limited contingent, of Soviet forces. That was its official name, which meant limited by what? Limited by political constraints within Russia and internationally. And of course, what have the Americans got in Iraq today but a limited contingent? Exactly that, and for exactly the same reasons as Toby very precisely identified. The second historic point is that the Iranian Revolution laid the basis for a regional conflict that has continued to this day and which is, as Toby said, absolutely central to understanding what is happening in Iraq, and that is the conflict for dominance in the region between the United States and Iran. American politicians sometimes say that there are two countries in the world that they have not forgiven. And they're not talking about Korea, and they're not talking about Vietnam, which actually killed Americans. They're talking about the two countries which humiliated America and still defy it, namely Cuba and Iran. Iran by overthrowing the Shah, Iran by detaining the 444 days, the American hostages in very humiliating circumstances. Iran by killing hundreds of American Marines in Lebanon in the early 80s, and in general by holding out against the Shaytuni Bozorg, the Great Satan, as the Iranians like to call them, and by refusing to cry uncle, and really not showing much interest in even opening diplomatic relations, even with the Americans under Clinton. Very mildly, but nevertheless, deliberately, had tried to open them. Now, this conflict was seen in Iran itself. This conflict was evident in Lebanon in the 80s. After all, Iran is the main backer of Hezbollah, and Iran has much more influence in Lebanon than has the United States. Let's be clear about that. It is evident in Central Asia, where the United States has quite successfully limited Iran's economic but not philosophical or ideological influence, and it is a fundamental feature in what is happening in Iraq today. In effect, in Iraq today, you have two conflicts which intersect. As Toby was saying, you have the insurgency of perhaps 20,000 people in different groups with the support of much of the Sunni population and also various Shiite groups like Muqtada al-Sadr fighting the Americans, but not necessarily entirely opposed at the end of the day to a political solution, because negotiations on this matter are taking place all the time. And then you have a quite separate conflict between Iran and the United States for ultimate domination within a post-war Iraq. And as things now stand, there is absolutely no doubt, and here I entirely agree with Toby, I even go further than him, that the winners look like they're going to be Iran. Iran is the real occupying power in Iraq, not the United States. They have the intelligence agents. They have the economic projects. They have the people in the army. They have the people in the political parties who are gradually taking over the administration of the country. And the more that the Americans seek to follow their two, in themselves, utterly plausible disengagement paths, which are elections on the one hand and institution buildings on the other, the more they're handing influence to the Iranians. And whether or not Iranian officers are running the Badr Brigade, these people are not to be underestimated. They fought an eight-year war with Iraq to get this goal, and they're going to get it. They may, as students of the communist period, be aware that if they have too heavy a hand, they'll end up having in Iraq what the Russians had in China, which is an ideological client which revolts against them. And they may, but Iranians are not noted for their modesty, they may indeed even hold back. But that conflict, which, as I say, has been going on for a long time, was one that originated at the time of the Arkov crisis. The third trend released in the early 80s was, of course, the rise of jihadi Sunni radicalism. The Sunni militants not just committed to fighting their own governments, as in Egypt or elsewhere, or in Yemen, but jihadi militants fighting on an international scale, above all in Afghanistan. And it's out of that jihadi radicalism that bin Laden and his group and those associated with him have come. And of course, if Afghanistan was a training ground for that leadership, for its transnational army, Bosnia and Chechnya were to follow. And of course now, as we know, a whole transnational youth is being trained in or inspired by Iraq. The Saudis won't say it publicly, the Kuwaitis won't say it publicly, But they are detaining dozens of young men every week trying to leave their respective countries to go and fight in Iraq. And for every one that they detain, one wonders how many are actually getting there. What they actually do when they get there may be a quite other matter. But the least one can say, and here the irony which Toby pointed to, that by going into Iraq, the United States has stoked the flames of this Sunni jihadi radicalism for many years to come. And here I recommend to you a book by one of our LSE graduates, Professor Fawaz Girgis, of George Mason University, called The Far Enemy, a discussion of how the jihadis, having failed in large measure to take over in their own countries, above all in Egypt, because Al-Qaeda is in many ways not just a reflection of the war in Afghanistan, it's a reflection of the conflict in Egypt in the 80s and 90s in which they lost. How that has now become a significant, if minoritarian, trend within radical Islam as a whole. The fourth trend that was shaped at that time was the neoconservative bloc within the United States. Rumsfeld and Doug Feith and Wolfowitz and all these people were people formed in the late 70s and early 80s. It was said of Rumsfeld that he's part of a Gerald Ford sleeper cell. If any of you remember who Gerald Ford was. And much of the language which they use is from that period, that start from threat inflation. I mean, Mary Calder and I used to work for a radical think tank in Washington. We spent all our time with Mike Clare and Bill Arkin and all these people showing how the estimates of the Soviet military balance and the effectivity of SS-20s was exaggerated and so forth. Of course, it didn't make any difference because they were on their crusade. But we did our work on the military balance. And what happened over Iraq in the run-up to the election 2003 was just another example of threat inflation. I mean, even more grotesque threat inflation than probably in the time of the Second Cold War. At the same time, the neoconservatives have, very importantly, a major moral and political agenda within the United States, and they believe in the appropriate use of American military power. But to understand where they've come from and to understand why they invaded Iraq, you have to go back to this right-wing intelligentsia formed, as I say, in the late 1970s and early 1980s. If we move on to the present, as I say, I view the situation in Iraq as, in a sense, the intersection of these two quite different wars, the war of jihadi radicalism and Sunni radicalism more generally, against regional states and against the US on the one hand, and also against Israel in the case of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and on the other, this regional conflict from Afghanistan to Lebanon between the United States and Iran. Clearly, you have now in both Washington and Tehran highly ideological leaderships who are capable of miscalculation. They're also capable of great violence and self-deception. And this is something that is extremely worrying. But I think that we also see something that I've tried to argue for in a loose sort of way, which is a changed geographic and strategic map in the Middle East in terms of what I've called, for want of a better word, the Greater West Asian Crisis. Now, when I say Greater West Asia, I mean the Arab world plus Iran, which normally you'd refer to as the Middle East, but also Afghanistan, also Kashmir, also Pakistan. In other words, a much wider West Asian area in which what were previously relatively separate conflicts and concerns have been brought much closer together. Now, at one level, this is true at the interstate level, above all at the level of nuclear weapons. The major consequence of the Indian and Pakistani nuclear explosions of 1998 and the failure of the international community to react in any serious way against them was and is to provoke a nuclear race in the Middle East. And that is part of the explanation for what the Iranians are doing. But they're not the only ones. I had a phone call from another one of our well-placed alumni the other day from Dubai. He said, tell your Iranian friends that if they think they can get nuclear weapons in a few years, we can get them first. I presume he knew what he was talking about and indeed where to go, which is country somewhere between Iran and India. It's even said they have a few there already with their names on it, but we'll wait and see. So that what was previously, for example, an Israeli-Egyptian conflict over Israel's possession of nuclear weapons and the Egyptian desire to have them or to prevent the Israelis, is now linked through this greater West Asian crisis to the Iranian-Iraqi, Iranian-Afghan story and on to South Asia as well. At the same time, at the popular level, you have the emergence of a sense of interlocked crisis, so that people in the Arab world and in Pakistan and in the Muslim parts of Europe and also in the former republics of the Soviet Union feel that Palestine, Bosnia, Chechnya, Iraq, Afghanistan, not to mention the Moro Islands or whatever else, are in some ways linked in a way that was not previously the case. And of course, the most obvious index of this is the emergence of, really for the first time in modern history, of a genuinely transnational rebel army. Much more transnational than, say, the armies of the Spanish Republic were during the Spanish Civil War. They're not that transnational, it has to be said, first of all, because the leadership is basically Egyptian and Saudi, and secondly, they're not entirely free of state sponsorship, because I do not believe that Al-Qaeda or the Taliban could survive in the way they do if they were not still enjoying the protection of at least some elements in the Pakistani state. And if you don't believe me, I would urge you to go to Afghanistan and talk to officials there who have no doubt about this matter whatsoever. But nevertheless, you have this transnational army with people from 40 countries, including people from Western Europe, Australia, the United States, converts, and all the rest of it, as part of this new greater West Asian crisis. And therefore, when Toby talks about the consequences of Iraq, these are consequences that we felt much more widely, and probably much more widely than was the American defeat in Vietnam. Quick conclusions. I was in Washington at the end of November, around the time of Thanksgiving, and that is a time when it is normal for congressmen to return home, those seeking re-election, and start raising funds for next year's election campaign. And the funds were not forthcoming. And the reason for this is not because the president lied about weapons of mass destruction, nor, unfortunately, because of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, of which most Americans really couldn't care that much, although some honorably have done so, like McCain. It is because of the casualties, and particularly the wounded who are returning. And congressmen visiting Walter Reed and Annenberg and all the other military hospitals around Washington have been coming to Congress and reporting on what they've seen. And also these people are showing up in constituencies. You can hide a corpse, but you cannot hide a person who's had their face or their legs or their arms blown off. The result is that there is a serious crisis in Washington. Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney are isolated and cocooned, but in the Pentagon and in the ministries and in Congress, the realization is there that the United States is the enemy, that they should leave, and that a major blunder has taken place. How long it will take for this to work through, I don't know. But in many ways, the game is already up, all the more so because of the point I made earlier, that the more the Americans carry out and organize elections which do have support and which are legitimate, the more they are handing power to pro-Iranian parties, and the more they build up the army and the intelligence services and other such institutions, the more the Iranians have institutions to infiltrate. What is the solution? The only possible way forward is through a good old institution of the Cold War, much maligned, the International Conference, as in Vietnam or as in other disputes of that time. Without some minimal agreement between the neighboring states, who are all keeping their hand in, both with the Iraqi government and with the opposition, and I've no doubt the Iranians have their hand in with the Sunni militants, ideologically unpleasant as that may be for them, without some minimal understanding, the situation will only get worse. If there is to be a timetable for an American withdrawal, it should be one to which responsible Iraqi parties, including sections of the resistance, and also who are negotiating with the Americans on a daily basis, as well as regional states, agree to. But it has also to be on the basis of a realization by the United States that this grandiose plan to remodel Iraq, let alone use the remodeling of Iraq to remodel the Middle East, has failed in a spectacular form. And it is not perhaps an accident, as we used to say, that this is all taking place on the 50th anniversary of the disastrous Anglo-French-Israeli assault on Suez, another occasion for the humbling of imperial dreams and the turning of historic pages. I myself, knowing Iran as I do, and it's a country I've known now for 42 years, I first went there. I went there in my school uniform, in a way, as I like to put it. I was 19 at the time. Do not particularly relish the thought of Mr. Ahmadinejad and his people taking over, having a strong influence in Iraq. And I also worry greatly about what they're doing inside Iran. And I also think, for what it's worth, it's a bit of amateur psychoanalysis, that one of the reasons for his support for Holocaust denial is because he wants to deny all the people he killed, and he and his associates have killed, using the violence of the Iranian state against their own opposition in the conflicts of the 1980s. I also think that he and others must be rather discomforted to see Saddam Hussein on trial for all the problems of that trial, because they know very well that one day they may be, and indeed should be, on trial as well, and I very much hope that one day they will be. So this is not a very optimistic scenario. There is a way out, which involves diplomacy and involves negotiation. The costs are very high for this extraordinary ideological blunder, which Toby has described so well. Thank you.
Okay, we have at least 20 minutes for questions and answers, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions. If you could keep your questions relatively short, we do not want long interventions which re-describe what the speakers have said or denounce them for their various ideological degenerative forms. So could we begin in this very hot room? I see many hands going up, several at the bottom. Do I see some at the top as well? Great. I'll take two at a time, and I'll start with the gentleman in blue at the back. I'll take the gentleman in blue here, and then we'll start there. Yeah, please, if you could.
Yeah. Well, the point is, what I then sent, obviously, what Toby Dodge has said is now conventional wisdom about, you know, the current joke in Washington is
right.
The war on Iraq is over and Iran has won. Well, you've illustrated that. But the point, what I don't understand is that, what I'm saying, 6 years after the first Gulf War, both Bush Sr. and Colin Powell wrote in their memoirs as to why an invasion of Iraq would be a rather stupid thing to do. Bush Sr. wrote in 1996, we could still be occupying a basically hostile land. Colin Powell wrote in his memoirs in 1995, the president promised the American people that this would not become a Persian Gulf of Vietnam. And Powell goes on to quote the US ambassador to Saudi Arabia, who says that the overthrow of Saddam would automatically strengthen Iran and Syria, enemies of America. So the point is all what you're talking now was all written now. I don't understand why this wasn't grasped by the people who, the neocons who planned this war.
Why were they so dumb, I think, was the question. Question in there, please.
Yeah, my question is, what about Syria, the third country in the axis of evil? What are the implications of all this for the future of Syria?
Syria, and the man with the red scarf on the red hat.
Professor David Harvey also mentioned the role of China and the control of the tap of oil in Iraq, which he posits is one of the reasons why the U.S. went in there as well. Could you comment on how that sort of new type of Cold War is going to affect this situation?
Right, there's three to be getting on with. Toby, do you want to kick on? Use the mic, mate.
Sure, yeah. It's not only Bush and Powell, but Cheney. Cheney wrote very long and eloquently about why they didn't want to get caught up in the quagmire of a country they didn't understand, ironically then. Now, I've written quite a bit on this and thought quite a bit about this, and I think in the aftermath of 9/11, as I tried to hint at in the paper, that there was clearly a shock and a trauma that across America as a whole that the neocons capitalized on, but also wanted to utilize. Now, they wanted to impose a new set of international relations focused on what they saw were the unstable creations of decolonization. They wanted to row back on Westphalian sovereignty, constrain it, and leverage demands from the states in the developing world about weapons of mass destruction, about terrorism, about banking transparency. Now, if you're going to do that, say, right, we're going to do that, we have to do that, and you look around, and there's one guy in the middle of the Middle East, the most sensitive region in your outlook, basically sticking two fingers up at Washington and saying, I'm still here. I've been here for 13 years. I've rejected the demands of the international community. And anyone who traveled to Baghdad after the mid-90s, Saddam was intent on turning it into a new kind of Bandung, that every two-bit radical from across the developing world was brought into Baghdad and funded to a greater or lesser degree. So I think, you know, the tallest poppy, as it were, had to be cut down, that in order to make the post 9/11 Bush foreign policy goals real and scary, coercive, then Iraq, then Saddam had to be taken down. I think it's in real term politics, it's as simple as that. On Syria, I mean, Syria is a fascinating country, and its role. I mean, I've been saying, as equally as Iran, Damascus has been playing very high stakes poker in Iraq. The borders are not sealed. There are clearly, what should we call it, strategic depth that the insurgency has gained from at least some of its senior members living in and around Damascus. And Damascus has kept coming back to Washington and saying, we can negotiate, we can do a deal. Let's haggle. What's it worth? And Washington has continually rejected to do exactly what Fred suggested, which is a regional multilateralization of the problem. Meanwhile, this high-stakes poker may not have brought their house crashing down on Damascus in Baghdad, but clearly did in Beirut. Now, if we believe the reports that if a deal can be done between Damascus and Washington on Baghdad, Beirut will be mediated, reports coming out of Washington, not Damascus, then the peril of the situation has been realized in Washington, and Washington is reaching out to Damascus. However, something rather strange has happened since the transfer of power from Assad Senior to Assad Junior. There has been a drop in the coherence of the Syrian state. That this is in no way regime change, state collapse, low-hanging fruit, but power has become less coherent. That the old man handing over the reins, the reins of power handed over, the Syrian state has become less coherent, power has become more personalized and spread about amongst that ruling elite and on a local level. So I think the Syrian regime faces grave problems internally and is playing with fire. After all, it was Sunni jihadists that came within a whisker in 1982 of removing the regime. So allowing Syrian jihadists at the most benign to move across your territory is to believe that there won't be significant blowback, which undoubtedly I think there will be.
Fred? The question of why they invaded Iraq has been obscured for all of us here, or whatever, in Western Europe or the United States, by the whole other debate about the lies and the weapons of mass destruction. Let's put that on one side. Why did they actually do it? It is even now an extraordinary question. And secondly, it clearly pertains to all sorts of broader debates that we have in universities, but also in public life, is what is the nature of the American empire, what is the nature of power in the modern world? Because none of the simple explanations, pressure from public opinion, pressure from the military-industrial complex, oil, they don't add up. And we, as it happens, there are quite a lot of relatively good books out of Washington about all this. And in the end, as Toby's saying, it does appear to come, obviously it's multi-causal, but two things absolutely key. One is the power, decision-making power, of a very small number of people, 5 or 6 or 7 within the US state, who simply defied all the others and took this decision. So it's not in the Middle East dictatorships that the ruler and his cronies takes all the decisions. It turns out to be in the most established democracy in the world. Secondly, the power of ideology. There is some sense in which they believe that to make American power credible, above all in the aftermath of 9/11, which is a massive humiliation, that they, and of course they still haven't found bin Laden, and they haven't found the anthrax, and they haven't arrested anybody, they haven't actually convicted a single person in the US for 9/11. Compared to in Spain, they've got 250 people in jail for March the 11th and associated things. The power of ideology itself, one has to come back to this. I'm not saying that that's a full answer. I'm saying actually, but it's a real intellectual challenge as well as a public policy challenge, and it will keep many a PhD student going for quite. It'll stuff the RIE for many a decade to come with theses on all of it. But the trigger, the specific answer to your question, if they were so smart in the 1990s, what went wrong, apart from the fact that it was a more right-wing group of neoconservatives, the one who prepared the famous report for Netanyahu in 96 and all the rest, it was 9/11. 9/11 changed America and changed the situation in Washington and allowed them to do something which a minority of them wanted to do. I remember Rumsfeld, when he was told that 9/11 had been carried out by bin Laden, who was in Afghanistan, and they should attack Afghanistan, he said, but why go after the little guy? Which was in the end, they went after Saddam, as we know.
Right, so
but the really big guy is Tehran, and they haven't gone after him yet.
We'll wait and see about that, won't we, Fred? Yeah, in the next few days, watch the space. Yeah, please.
This question is for Dr. Dodge, and you briefly mentioned something about the 2008 presidential elections in the United States, and you kind of predicated that it would turn out to be a referendum on the war and the rising casualties, and that kind of concerned me because if you look at the Democratic Party as well, a lot of the people that are in the Democratic Party and have been touted as front runners like Senator Clinton have basically taken identical roles, I mean, identical positions on the war as President Bush and, to an extent, some of the neocons that you mentioned. So, and also in 1973, there was an anti-war candidate that ran against President Nixon, and he lost in 49 out of 50 states. So I'm just wondering what's really going to change in 2008 to indicate that the outcome that you're implying, and thank you.
Thanks very much. Was another hand up? Yeah, please, just take the mic. Yeah, please.
What's the potential and actual role for Russia in the arc of crisis?
Right, okay. Do you want to start with the first one or leave,
yeah,
Russia,
leave Russia
to Fred?
Fred, that's right.
Or Fred to Russia.
I take your point about, about Clinton, who seems to have become more Republican than Bush in these later days in an attempt to seize the U.S. middle ground, wherever that lays these days. But my point would be on twofold. If you look at the traditional wing of the Republican Party, as opposed to their neoconservative coupmeisters or whatever they did to the Republican Party, they are much, much more critical, much, much more careful. There's even talk of a coup in the run-up to the midterms, that they've got to claw back their party from the moral majority and the neoconservatives and get it back on traditional realist foreign policy. So I agree that the strange journey of Hillary Rodham Clinton to the right in pursuing her own husband's radical instrumentalism when it comes to electoral politics is intriguing, but I don't think the battle is there. The much more interesting battle is within the ranks of the Republican Party. That to one side. And you could argue that the last presidential election was a referendum and Bush won. This constant drip, drip, drip of casualties, the increasing coherence amongst thinking American political opinion that Bush doesn't have an answer and more troops isn't the answer, but that cutting and running has huge ramification, means that it will be a large issue. And by the time we get to 2008 and the very nature of electoral politics to polemicize or divide the debate, I think it will be a big issue, and I think pulling out and blame will be key issues, and whether Clinton runs or not.
But why are the Democrats so pusillanimous on the issue then?
Well, there's Democrats and there's Democrats. Joe Biden, who is also limbering up for a presidential run, has led the charge before the Republicans against the war.
Okay, yeah, Fred?
I hesitate to make predictions about American politics. I was the Time Out correspondent at the Republican convention in 1972, and I saw John Wayne make the keynote speech.
And you liked it, I remember.
The slogan was 4 more years, and then 1 more year or 2 more years, and he was out. And anything could happen for 2008. But I would advise you the view of our dear IR professor colleague in Chicago, who was my host a few weeks ago, Professor Don Mearsheimer. He said, look, they're going to lose Iraq, but he said, we're such a powerful country, it won't make any difference. The economy will continue to grow, the political system will be immune, and the rest of the world will pay the price. We're not going to pay any price for this, he said. Even though, by the latest calculations, which I have no way of evaluating, the cost of this war is going to be something called between $1 and $2 trillion, which is quite a lot of money, given the US GDP as a whole is about 13. Russia doesn't have a major role. It is now probably the most influential country again in Afghanistan through the Central Asian states whose armed forces it controls, and by default of Iran and Pakistan being in a weaker position, it does seem that Russia is increasingly uneasy about the new government in Iran, and while they're capable of doing business with Iran, I don't think that Ahmadinejad's Holocaust remarks and wiping Israel off the face of the map go down very well in Moscow, because whatever else Putin and Yeltsin may have done in their time, anti-Semitism is not a card either of them ever played and have kept well away from, indeed in this case to their credit. And I think that the Russians are much more concerned now to push the Americans out of the former Soviet republics like Uzbekistan, like perhaps also Kyrgyzstan, in which the Americans have had a role in the past, since 9/11. But this, all in the context of the consequence of all of this, which may be more important than any other, which we haven't got around to mentioning, which is the greatest beneficiary of all this stuff, is China. The rise of China economically anyway is going to do with 9/11 and Iraq. But while the West is preoccupied with what is basically a conflict in the greater Mediterranean area, 9/11 and Iraq and all this stuff, China's strategic, economic, and political power is growing, and the Chinese must be absolutely delighted that the Americans are so distracted, and long may they remain so, and the Russians view this with alarm as well.
Thanks very much. There was a question up here, then a question with the lady down here. Yeah, please.
Yes, a question about China. If the conflict does emerge between the U.S. and Iran, can Iran count on China's support? Thank you.
Okay, hold on. Let's just take another question, Fred. Yeah, please. Yeah.
I think I would find some more light shed on understanding all this if someone could briefly say what they reckoned was the cause of the war between Iraq and Iran. I know we're very used to hearing Big Bag Saddam went and invaded Iran, but I think Fred Halliday has seemed to suggest that Iran versus America has been sort of on the cards, and no doubt America encouraged Saddam Hussein, but it's going to obviously get a bit more relevant now. We were told he was such a big baddie, especially because of all the millions he killed, and lots of them were in the Iranian war. So if there is any brief explanation that you think of the real causes of that war, it would be helpful. The beginning on it.
Could I add just a rider to both Fred and Toby, a kind of provocation? When will the United States bomb Iran? Because everything you've said so far, it seems to me, I mean, a hegemonic power facing the kind of problems it's facing, seeing Iran, which was self-evidently the only prediction one could get right, that Iran would be the beneficiary, seeing in Iraq, seeing also this weapons of mass destruction, which is not going to be solved either through diplomacy or sanctions, because that will affect oil prices, all the indications, it seems to me, and everything you said tonight seems to reinforce me in the view that somebody's going to do some military things in Iran pretty damn soon, or at least over the next few weeks or months. Do you agree? Right.
I'll leave China and Iran Iraq to Fred.
Yeah, you can't do that. You answer that question.
But I'll tackle that.
All right, try that one.
As one travels through the Beltway, and the last 2 years have taken me on some rather surprising and quixotic journeys and through the Beltway, one finds two views. The first is by the technocratic targeters, whose job it was to draw up the military bombing plans for Iran. And America's an amazing place because you can speak to them and talk to them off the record and they'll tell you, and they look very worried. They say there is no military option for Iran. We've just drafted it. It's not a good option. We're talking about setting back a program, not stopping it, and the consequences of that will be mass civilian casualties. The collateral damage, to use their own terminology, will be huge. Mm-hmm. And will only stop a program, will only put a pause on a program. So that's the first thing, and that's the view I would take. Even the craziest of neoconservative crazies have stopped talking about military action in Iran. The second view is a very senior State Department government service officer who I had dinner with recently, and I said, well, what really worries you about Iraq? He said, it's not Iraq. It's as my nightmare, what sits me bolt up in bed in the wee hours screaming, is that as they pull out of Iraq, they launch an air campaign against Iran to kind of as a smokescreen for their defeat and their departure. But I don't, saying that, I don't think military action against Iran is in any way imminent.
Right. Can we keep those words on the record?
Always.
Okay. Fine. Fred.
On Iran and China, China will slow, but I don't think will formally block sanctions and other measures voted at the UN Security Council. But in effect, China will help Iran to lessen or fundamentally evade any economic sanctions which are imposed as far as exporting of oil and as far as importing of consumer goods is concerned. As far as access to capital on international markets and technology to update the Iranian industrial and oil infrastructure, which desperately needs it after 25 years, probably the Chinese can't help them that much anyway, and the Americans may be able to block that. But China will not go down the line for Iran, but will certainly help it to survive and lessen the effects of any sanctions. The causes of the Iran-Iraq war are very interesting. Let's not forget that the event that provoked the war, or rather that occasioned the war, was the Iranian Revolution. Because when the Iranian Revolution happened, Iran rejected all previous constraints which it agreed with Iraq about propaganda and supporting opposition, and called for a revolution in Iraq. And also various incidents happened along the frontier in which both sides shot at each other quite merrily. So clearly Saddam wanted to attack Iran when it was weak in order to establish his dominance in the Gulf, and he thought he could get away with it. He failed because he didn't win within a fortnight, if I can put it that way, because the Iranians then rallied. But the rhetoric and the policies of the Iranian government played a role in the origin of that war. Saddam didn't need to have instructions from Tel Aviv or Washington because he could see that Iran was isolated because of the hostage crisis. The Iranians were detaining the Americans. And he very effectively, through his people in New York, blocked the Security Council from deeming it an act of aggression for at least 2 or 3 weeks after the attack, even though it was a clear violation of the UN Charter. And that's one of the reasons why Iran was so alienated from the UN thereafter. So, yes, Saddam attacked Iran on the 23rd of September 1980, but the Iranians have to be seen to play a role. This was not the Nazi invasion of Poland, but this was a much more complicated event with right and wrong on both sides. As far as bombing Iran is concerned, the Israeli chief of staff said recently there was no technical problem about doing it. I don't think he would have said that lightly. On the other hand, I am not a spy or an engineer. None of us are. One hears about dispersal. One hears that they can't actually find enough of it. I have no way of knowing, and other people say yes. But my view is, if it is technically possible to do even 70% to the Iranians what the Israelis did to Iraq in 1981, then either America or Israel will do it sooner or later. And had that not been the case until recently, for all the Iraqi reasons that we know, when you have an Iranian president who says, it's very clear what he said, it's not a mistranslation, that Israel should be wiped off the face of the earth, that is exactly what he said, mafshodan, wiped out, then, given the history of the 20th century, I don't think he's going to be left in peace for that long, frankly. I think it's improbable. But the Americans, the real constraint may not be the physical or engineering constraint. It may be what price will they then pay in Europe.
I'm going to take one final set of questions. I've got somebody down here who had their hand up in yellow at the back and at the back here. Sorry, I did a lot of hands have gone up. Yeah, please, make it brief too, please. Yeah. Last round of questions.
Quick
yeah.
question and an observation. As a foreign relations historian who lives inside the Beltway, I would sort of agree that even after this war, which I think was a crime and not just a mistake, the U.S. is still going to have somewhere in the neighborhood of 800 military bases around the world, several dozen in Central Asia. And I was wondering if you could say something about the shifting of the American sort of military geography in the Middle East, and say something about the role of Saudi Arabia, which is still funding the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, something which is not being talked about in the news, but which CIA and other intelligence officials are quietly very worried about.
Right. One at the back, and then one finally over here. Yeah, please.
A question about political Islam. Is it on the way up, or is it on the way out? In the sense that the French literature seems to suggest that jihadist movements, at the end of the day, are a product of the failure of political Islam, and they're not going to win. Well, what you're saying about Iran seems to hint, on the contrary, to a resurgence, yet again, of political Islam. And I would like both speakers to clarify on this point.
Thanks very much. And one final one over here, please. Yeah.
You've both been very pessimistic about Iraq, and I don't necessarily disagree, but I just wonder if you're not being overly pessimistic in the sense that surely whether one regards any war as a success or a failure is largely a matter of kind of pre-existing expectations. And it strikes me as very... At the time of the first Gulf War, the Pentagon's own estimate of the number of American troops that would probably die in the war was on the order of 17,000, and that was considered acceptable. It strikes me as very strange that in 16 years, 2,000 is now considered disastrous. I don't mean to be flippant, but I'm just making a serious point. And the second thing is about the degree of Iranian domination, because you may be right, but isn't it also the case that what the Americans are trying to do at the moment is negotiate with the Sunnis, and of course they already have fairly good relations with the Kurds. Well, good, again, a matter of how you look at it. But is there, are you not being overly pessimistic? Is there not a potential that you could balance the Iranian-dominated Shia with a kind of making some sort of deal with the Kurds and the Sunnis, and that this could be slightly less disastrous than you're both suggesting?
Okay, thanks. I'll leave it there. I know there's a lot of people who had their hands up for a long time, but I just want to take a round robin now. Fred, you spoke second, but why don't you therefore start the concluding comments?
Well, I'll go in the reverse order. We may be wrong about the Iranian influence in Iraq. Most Iraqis don't want Iranian domination. But Iran has the institutions, it has the money. Sistani himself is an Iranian. He doesn't even have an Iraqi passport, although he's lived most of his life in Iraq. And the Kurds themselves, although they don't love the Iranians, know that Iran is their only friendly state, certainly not Turkey, certainly not the Sunni Arab states. So while Barzani and Dalabani are not Iranian clients, they are certainly long-established junior allies of Tehran and have been there many more times than they've been to Washington. I don't think you can give a general answer to the question about political Islam. The causes of political Islam are deep in the societies. They also lie in the exhausting of secular ideologies in the second half of the Cold War. We come back to that point in all these countries. And one of the tragedies of the Iraqi situation is there are no national parties left, no nationalist parties, Iraqi parties, no communist party, because everything is the Turkoman this and the Sunni that and the Shiite that. And that also goes back to the exhausting of these ideologies in the Cold War, both nationalism and communism and variants thereof. You cannot generalize as between the Iranian policy as a state and Sunni radicalism, and you cannot generalize as between Algeria, where it's gone down, and Egypt, where it's gone down and been accommodated, and other countries such as Saudi Arabia or Iraq, where it's certainly gone up. And of course, you have political Islamic parties which are not violent, which are in power, and our dear allies, including the president and prime minister. One of them was sitting at this platform not some weeks ago, the president of Turkey, the prime minister of Turkey, who's certainly the head of an Islamist party. So the very question is mistaken. Now, the French experts are right to say that Al-Qaeda is not going to win. And secondly, they and Fawaz Girgis are right to say that this strategy of attacking in Madrid and in London and in New York reflects the failure to take power in those countries. Indeed, the loss of power in, to some extent, in Sudan and even more so in Afghanistan, and the failure to take power in Algeria and Egypt. But if the causes are this deep and Iraq is contributing to these causes, it's going to be with us for a long time. I think at the end of the day, you have to go country by country. I think political Islam is doing rather well in Palestine, by the way, and with consequences that we may see in the elections. When it's said that the Saudis are funding this Sunni jihad, we come to a very big question, which is where does the Saudi state end and private princely business interests begin? Indeed, is there a Saudi state? Or is the whole thing a Saudi state? Because there is no private sector in any proper sense of the term, since everything depends on government money in one form or another. But that Saudis are funding the jihad, that Saudi, young Saudis are going there or trying to go there in significant numbers is well known. You mentioned this large deployment of US forces, something that we must remember is quite new. The Americans never fought in the Middle East in any serious way until 1990. Not in the Cold War, in other words. But not sure they're able to do very much. And remember Toby's final point, that this insurrection has done in the 2000s what the Vietnamese did in the 1970s. They have humbled this vast army. It doesn't mean the army is going to go away. But let us say something else. Nobody says this openly, but the Americans have stopped patrolling in Iraq. They've stopped pursuing terrorists. They're in their barracks, institution building. There's been a massive shift, as there has with the British. They've stopped going out. They go protected convoys from one barracks to the other, and that's largely it. So they've already retreated enormously. And the first people to notice that are, of course, the Iraqis themselves.
What about the optimism-pessimism issue, Fred? Do you want to deal with that?
The as Hegel said, history will be the final. Die Weltgeschichte ist das Weltgericht. That's the
good. What a great answer, and in German. Toby?
How do I follow that? In English, sadly.
In Arabic, maybe.
On the military geography, it's not a flipping point. And you have this mammoth security network, this army, this capacity, technology spending, certainly. But that military-industrial complex is driven by politicians and by political opinion. And I think that the hammering that opinion is taking in Iraq and the ramifications of that is what I was trying to flag up. And the war is deeply unpopular amongst not only the top brass, but you can follow it right down to quite a low level of officer authority, and they believe that they've been stitched up by a series of politicians who never saw action. It's not for me to comment on that. So I think you're right, the military geography, it will remain, but the direction and the confidence, if not arrogance, that it's deployed may well be drawn back. I mean, Fred's exactly right on the Sunni insurgency. Early on, you'd hear very plausible reports of senior members of the royal family visiting wakes for young men killed in action in Iraq, and you say, have you learned nothing from 9/11? You hear counter reports about a lot of work being done to seal that border, which is largely irrelevant because they go through Jordan and through Syria. So I think it is a matter of public, private, and you know, the state itself has put a lot of effort into sealing the border. What scares me, and Fred alluded to much more powerfully than I did, is that each security system network, each muhabarat of the neighbors is playing in. The Saudis were slow to play in, but are quickly gearing up. So what does Saudi intelligence do when it plays into a situation like that with all its money and its lack of capacity? It funds people it knows best. And you don't have to run down the food chain to work out who'll get the money. On Islamism, I'd agree with Fred, not much to add to that. The revolution is coming, the revolution will come in its peak, it's not coming anymore. It's a testament to some extent to the capacity, the ability of indigenous Middle Eastern states to fight insurgencies brutally and to win. Al-Qaeda was created with the offshoring of Egyptian Islamic radicals. They're there. They may be a motley and ragtag bunch, but they're not going away. So I think domestically the states of the Middle East are comparatively strong. Internationally, the international community has proved to be very vulnerable to that form of warfare. On expectations and pessimism, my looking to Iran to provide institutional capacity is the most optimistic I've been in about 6 months. What Iraq desperately lacks is institutional capacity, military, governmental, or political. The political parties are all exile parties stitched together and thrown into the breach, as it were. The government collapsed and has been extremely bad at being regenerated. If there is administrative capacity, it's an extremely local level. I don't think we'll see, ultimately, I bet not on an Iranian client state, but on a situation comparable to Afghanistan in as much as that you will have pools of limited geographic stability in seas of violent instability. And those pools may be close to Basra, may be close to Kuwait or Iran than the rest of the country, Kurdistan to Turkey, but I think that's where we're heading. On that basis, well, if you look at the RAND report on casualty tolerance, which I thought was really interesting, it doesn't say numbers are important. Numbers of death are not important. What is important is elite coherence and solidarity, and that elite coherence and solidarity is broken. So I think casualty tolerance is rapidly becoming a much more of an issue because the agreement, the elite agreement in Washington and Congress is now gone. And I think you'll see that in the US presidentials to revisit that last question. And yes, the Americans are negotiating with the Sunnis. But the Sunni or the insurgency that happens to be dominated by Sunnis, but their bottom line is, go home and we'll talk to you. I've interviewed key interlocutors between the US military, Langley, and the insurgency, and all their bottom line is, go home and we'll start talking to you. And secondly, when they try to negotiate with them, there is, unlike Vietnam or any other insurgency, there's no coherent party. So they're negotiating with a series of groups, which means their bottom line is a maximal demand, go home and we'll talk to you. So that's why I'm not optimistic. I think The US has no answer to the problem they face. The opposite, the insurgency is fractured but has an amazing capacity to increase its technological ability to kill people and is getting more brutal. And that leaves us with a kind of Hobbesian war of all against all, where the state is just one player deploying violence amongst many. And we've seen that in the outrageous situation of the Ministry of Interior and its own militia acting as an assassination squad without any judicial review and without any much criticism from the United States either. So that's why I'm so pessimistic.
Okay, thanks very much, Toby. Can I just, before thanking the two speakers this evening, first of all make an announcement. Next Tuesday, we continue the Cold War Studies Center's lecture with something maybe not so different. It's on the American Civil War. It's called The Civil War, Historical Memory and the United States Unity or Division. It'll be a terrific lecture by Professor David Blight from Yale University, and that's in association with the Guild of Lehrmen. And on the 7th of February, we have Professor Alan Brinkley from Columbia University who'll be speaking on the idea of an American century. I think this evening we've had a display of real knowledge, expertise and understanding of the region, the knowledge, the expertise and understanding which was completely ignored by those who made the decision to go to war. And unfortunately, we are now sitting, in a sense, after that war, analysing it. And it's a great pity that Toby wasn't listened to, and Fred indeed wasn't listened to, in my opinion. I stood on this platform 3 years ago making certain kinds of points, not as well or not in such an expert way on this. And one of the things I've unfortunately got right was how appalling it was bound to become. And I'm very unhappy that I was right at least on one issue over the last 30 years. Well, I've been right on two issues. The other one was the Cold War, but I won't go back with Fred over that one. Anyway, with no further ado, I want to thank you for coming this evening in such great numbers and to thank our two excellent speakers for this evening's discussion on the Middle East. Thanks very much indeed.
You're welcome, Alan.